From WXXI News in Rochester, this is Connections. I'm Scott Feibusch. In today for Evan Dawson, our connection this hour is one that we make pretty much every day of our lives, the one between how much money comes into our wallets and bank accounts and how much of it goes right back out. For many of us, money is a constant source of concern and of fascination, too. What made oil prices tumble to historic lows this past year, and what effect will that have on the broader economy? As unemployment rates continue to fall, will 2016 be the year you finally get that raise? And what's with the Fed and interest rates? Global politics are playing an ever bigger role in our domestic finances. Many experts say climate will be an ever bigger story moving forward, too. We will tackle all of those questions and more in the hour ahead with our guests. George Conboy is the president of Brighton Securities. Amit Bhatabial is the Arthur J. Gosnell Professor of Economics at RIT. And we want to hear from you, too, on the phone at 844-295-TALK, 844-295-8255, or on Twitter. I am at Scott Feibusch, all one word there. I want to start with you, George Conboy. If you could roll back the clock to December 29th, 2014, a year ago today, what would you tell yourself then that you really need to know about where the economy was going to be going in this year that's just ending now?
Well, it's a good question. It's funny, we were chatting before the show, and rather than getting into it, you held back your question so it would hit me unawares. If I had one thing that I wanted to know, if I could roll the clock back, it would be where energy prices were going to go in 2015. That was, I say there was a big thing that happened that was a surprise this year, and there was a small thing that happened that everyone expected this year. The big thing, of course, was oil prices continued going down dramatically this year. And the small thing was interest rates that's been expected for years. And when it finally happened this month, it was a 0.25% increase. But to know in advance that energy prices were going to do what they had done, anyone would have gladly known that this time a year ago.
If you had known that this time a year ago, what would you have put your money in?
Well, I'm not much of a speculator, but you would have to either short the energy markets, oil producers, natural gas pipelines, especially those that are more leveraged or have a lot of debt. So you'd either sell off the holdings and those things that you have, or if you were very aggressive, you'd go short those things, but move away from some energy investments in advance of that and be more cautious.
Amit, you're more on the theoretical side than on the practical, everyday investment advice. What surprised you the most in 2015? What didn't you see coming?
Well, I didn't quite expect the dramatic decline in oil prices that I saw, and I thought there would be some change in the attitude of the major OPEC producers such as Saudi Arabia. But until very, very recently, the attitude of Saudi Arabia in particular seems to be, we're just going to keep pumping as much as we can to try to keep the American producers, who are typically higher cost producers, basically out of the market and hopefully kick them out of the game altogether. So the extreme pumping that I saw on the part of Saudi Arabia did surprise me a little. And the other thing, I suppose you'll get to it in a couple of minutes, is the inclusion of the renminbi in the IMF group of reserve currencies. I knew that was going to happen, but I didn't think it would happen this quickly.
We will indeed get to that as we go more global. I want to spend a little bit of time on this issue of oil prices, because obviously, you know, for Joe average consumer, you're seeing that effect very clearly every time you go to the pump. And my gosh, even here in Rochester now, depending on where you go, you can see prices that are under $2 a gallon at retail. For us here, it seems like it's pretty much a good thing. Obviously, there are sectors of the U.S. economy that look at that and say, wait a minute, this could be trouble in some areas going forward, right?
That's true. So as consumers, we're, of course, all delighted that gas prices are so low. Every time we go to the tank to fill up our cars, it's a steal. We're saving a lot of money. There's no question about it. However, the fact of the matter remains that oil is a significant part of the GDP of many countries. Saudi Arabia, we just mentioned in a minute ago, other countries like Russia look to high oil prices to balance a significant portion of their budget. So for countries where oil and more generally energy prices are a significant part of the GDP, when there's so much fluctuation and this seemingly secular downtrend in the price of oil, they're going to have great difficulty in balancing their budget. And because oil is a significant part of the GDP, that shows up in declines in energy stocks across the board. We're not quite as affected in the United States, but we are. But the international activity in the realm of oil is what's particularly dramatic.
Well, I guess we're probably relatively less affected here in our region of the country, this is not an area heavily dependent on refineries. It's not an area heavily dependent on drilling. I imagine if you're riding the boom that North Dakota has had with fracking there, if you're Texas, if you're Louisiana, I imagine that's got to be a much bigger concern locally in areas like that and in Western Canada too.
Right? Sure. Housing is going to be a big deal in those areas. You're already starting to see that taper off. Another thing that goes along with some of what Amit had said was the relationship of the U.S. dollar to many other currencies. Risen a lot. We notice that when you go across the border to Canada. I think the loonie now is about, 71 cents, mm-hmm. somewhere around there.
Right.
As recently as a couple of years ago, it was at a slight premium to the U.S. dollar. We think of Canada as a big country and it's a big landmass, but there are only about 12 people up there, and 10 of them work in the energy business. So the Canadian dollar is soft. It's going to mean that U.S. imports of foreign goods are a little more reasonably priced with a strong dollar like this, and that will help bring back some of these countries that are affected by oil if they can export more. It'll mean that we get cheaper imports and we get cheaper gasoline.
You had mentioned the question about the OPEC nations and continuing to pump oil into this glut now. Do you see that changing going forward in 2016? Is there any effort to try to stop that?
So there are two offsetting effects with respect to the biggest player in OPEC, Saudi Arabia. One is their desire to basically make sure that they retain market share to the extent possible. That seems to be a very big Saudi concern, to not give up market share to any other players. So that suggests a policy of continuing to pump to make sure that new entrants don't get into the market and they retain their share to the extent possible. On the other hand, they're hemorrhaging big time in terms of balancing their own budget and losing foreign exchange at a fairly rapid clip. So the net impact is going to be the result of those two forces. But at least for the next couple of months, I expect to see them continuing to pump.
Are there potential effects in terms of political stability in a region that's already as unstable as it is there?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, the Saudi monarchy has an implicit agreement with its citizenry that we're going to make you folks reasonably wealthy. We're going to extend the benefit of the kingdom's largesse every so now. And you basically make sure that you don't cause any unrest as far as challenging the Saudi kingdom, the House of Al-Saud, politically. But if that tacit agreement continues to fray in a significant manner, you could definitely see unrest. And all around Saudi Arabia, you have problems. And Saudi Arabia has its own problems with the Houthis in Yemen. And that's an unresolved issue. So you have geopolitical problems all around Saudi Arabia. So if the economic bargain doesn't hold up, you could definitely see more political unrest.
On the domestic side, we're already seeing effects on auto dealerships with people going in and buying bigger cars and buying more of them. Dealers around the country, I know, are saying that they're seeing really good end of the year numbers. Is that, George, is that holding up locally here too?
Holding up very well locally. They're having a hard time keeping some SUVs in stock, and people will go back and forth. You want that Prius or plug-in hybrid when gas prices are high, and you wouldn't expect people to have such short memories, but in the aggregate, consumers tend to have fairly short memories.
I was going to ask, what's the psychology there? Because I know I was just new car shopping, and at least for me, fuel economy was definitely still a concern. Yeah, it's nice to be paying $2 a gallon now, but it's not going to last forever necessarily. What goes on in the minds of a lot of consumers when they go into the dealership and, I can fill my tank now for $20 instead of $40?
I think it's a little bit more sophisticated. I'll give them some credit. And that is that folks are buying a car today and they probably don't expect to keep it for 10 or 15 years. They may lease it for 2 or 3 and figure that the oil price swing, when it ultimately swings back, might take a few years to get back where it was, and by then they'll be looking for another car. So a lot of times these new purchases are very situational in how it impacts someone's personal finances.
So having just traded in a 13-year-old car puts me on the outlying fringe of that trend.
You and me both. You and me both.
Indeed. What are some other effects that could potentially, I know obviously fuel prices have a huge effect on transportation of consumer goods. Are we seeing that come down to the consumer level yet? Are we seeing any impact on retail prices from the cost of transportation going down?
I'm not seeing that. In our domestic economy, I think there's a generally beneficial effect, but not specific effects like that.
I would agree with that. I mean, economists refer to this phenomenon called price stickiness, where prices tend to go up much more easily than they tend to come down. So even though gas prices are at a record low right now, we're not really seeing any kind of transportation premium being returned to consumers. Certainly, if you shop at a place like Wegmans, you're not seeing any price declines as a result of the fact that their transport costs have declined.
Will that come at some point? Is there any reason to expect that at some point, lagging the actual drop in fuel prices, that we'll see that if it stays low?
I don't think so. I don't expect any kind of transport premium, at least as far as consumers are concerned. Because even if prices continue to decline, I think there's going to be a wait-and-see attitude on the part of producers. Because as you pointed out a minute ago, this can't last. I mean, prices are going to go up. And so rather than, you know, refund or extend to consumers some kind of transportation premium, companies are just going to basically hold tight and do nothing about this particular phenomenon that we're seeing right now.
So I got two comments to that. One is we have to keep in mind that the transportation and logistics component of consumer goods or food or what have you generally would be a small portion of the overall cost. So even if that component goes down by 30-40%, the overall cost of the product is probably not going down very much. But the other thing is, Amit, what you just said, I don't disagree with it. But when I hear it said by someone else, it's something I would say myself. But when I hear it from someone else, I think, well, we all said a year ago, well, the oil prices can't stay down much longer. They ought to go up. And they certainly didn't do that this year. We were talking before the show started about what had happened in Houston back in 86 when oil prices went down to single digits per barrel. And this could be a protracted trough in oil prices for some of the things you, Amit, are saying about many of the big players want to keep pumping.
That's
nobody
right.
wants to give up market share. They all want to sell oil even if they're selling it cheaper.
That's right. But, you know, under sanctions, a country like Russia, for instance, it cannot continue to do what it is doing indefinitely. Sooner or later, the chickens are going to come home to roost. But when is that going to happen? That's the big question.
If only we could get out the crystal ball and
absolutely
and jump a year forward. We are talking money this hour on Connections. I am Scott Feibusch. In for Evan Dawson, George Conboy is with us. He's the president of Brighton Securities. Amit Bhatabial is the Arthur J. Gosnell Professor of Economics at RIT. We want to bring you into the discussion as well. Give us a call at 844-295-TALK, 844-295-8255. I am on Twitter at Scott Feibusch. Eager to hear your comments about how changing gas prices are affecting some of your personal economic decisions as we head into a new year. And how about interest rates, too? Let's tackle that at this point, since, as you said, George, at the top of the show, this is something everybody has expected to happen for several years at this point. And it finally happened. It was 0.25%, and it has done what?
Nothing so far. No real effect. You did have a fair amount of pent-up demand getting satisfied for people, those few people who had been, I don't know, living in a cave, who hadn't thought to refinance their mortgages. There was a lot of that going on this year, but a 25 basis point, we call it basis points, 0.25% increase, doesn't have a big net effect on your willingness to go out and buy a house or get a mortgage or buy a car or an appliance. It does signal that down the road we may see more increases that may have meaningful effects. But so far, that effect is not meaningful. It'll be nice if you're making a 0.5% in your savings account. It'll be nice if you're now making 0.75%, but I don't think it'll change your life.
Amit?
Yeah, I would agree with that. I mean, it's a small change, and the big thing is it was largely anticipated by the markets. And I think there's some dissension between the Fed Open Market Committee in terms of the extent of the raise that should, in fact, take place. So it's basically done that, so it's ensured its credibility, and now it's basically in a wait-and-see mode to see what happens to unemployment, what happens to inflation, and what happens to the economy more generally before it takes more aggressive action to increase rates.
So you don't think that this is something where they've said, okay, we've finally gotten away from 0% where we were for as long as we were. Now this gives us free rein to really start working with it and bringing the interest rates up higher still?
It certainly puts them in a position to do so, but whether they will actually do so, I have my doubts. I think any pattern of rate increases is going to be very gradual and calibrated very carefully to make sure that the economy is on the uptick and where they want, particularly with, say, numbers related to these two key metrics, inflation and unemployment.
When we look at unemployment numbers, there's certainly a lot of political controversy out there. And you know, we've seen the raw unemployment numbers going down pretty much quarter over quarter for several years now.
And yet there is this sense from some corners of the political world that say, well, yeah, but it doesn't count all of these people who've stopped looking for work. How valid is that concern, and how real is this recovery in jobs?
The concern is valid. I mean, it is true that a number of people have now simply stopped looking. But the other issue is, even for those who are actually working, they are not necessarily getting the number of hours that they would like to work. So they're employed, but they don't necessarily have the number of hours that they would actually like. Along with that, what we're not seeing, and this is the big part of the complaining that you hear about unemployment, is that we're not seeing wage growth to the extent that we would like. So people are employed, they have hours, the unemployment rate is actually coming down, but the kind of wage growth that people would like to see is largely been stagnant. And that's, I think, the primary cause for concern among people when they talk about unemployment and the numbers that go with it.
That's a good thing that we're, or that's a too bad thing, I should say, that we're not seeing wage growth. But the complement to that, of course, is we aren't seeing price growth. We're not seeing inflation, meaningful inflation. So your loaf of bread doesn't cost so much every year, and your gallon of gas costs 30% less this year. There's a counterbalancing effect, but I'll admit, everybody wants to get a raise. Everybody wants to make a little more and do a little better. So there's frustration in the marketplace from that.
Sure.
But there too, maybe, George, you can localize this a little bit to Rochester. We were talking a little before the show about the cost of living in San Francisco and in other big cities. How much of a bubble are we in, or is it those cities that are in a bubble? Where it's a very different economy if all of a sudden your rent is going up from $2,500 to $3,500 in a New York City or in a San Francisco, when here it's maybe going from $800 to $825.
There are different quality of life metrics, and there are very many of them are intangible. We just hired one of our senior managers out of New York City area, an investment banker in New York, came to work for us a year ago. He's our new CEO. And he had a 45-minute to an hour commute each way, each day, to get into lower Manhattan to go to work. He's making almost as much here as he was there. He's making less here. But he's got a commute that, when he tells his friends he has a 15-minute commute to Brighton from Bushnell's Basin, and they laugh at him, they think they're lying. They think he's lying to them. So there are quality of life issues here that are important, and there's the ability to live in a place like this and be confident that your wage can cover your expenses, because we're not in that bubble where you're going to get pushed out and you can't afford to live in the Bay Area, for example.
But one thing that, and not to get too far off the overall economic topic, one thing that I think has been underestimated in quality of life and doesn't seem to figure into that math for a lot of people is the weather. As much as we complain about our weather here, you look at what's hit the rest of the country pretty much nonstop for the last few years. We don't have big coastal storms. Right. We don't have tornadoes.
We're
we don't
the home
have
of no drama weather.
Yeah, it snows for a while in the winter, and then it gets nice again. Is that something that's under-factored into the cost of living here?
I'm sure the big property casualty insurer is factored in, but we don't generally.
I don't think it's factored into the extent that it should be. And here the public perception is more negative than it should be. You know, people think about Rochester, oh my goodness, gray 364 days of the year, cloud cover, the sun's rarely out. And we know that's not true. But it's also true at the same time that we get a lot of snow here. So if you don't like snow, don't come here. The stability of the housing market and the stability of life in general, notwithstanding.
And we have fresh water, too. And I'm wondering, looking sort of long-term into our economic future, and I mentioned some environmental concerns at the beginning, you know, that's we've seen in the West especially over the last few years what effects the lack of fresh water can have on economic development. Is that something that should stand Rochester and the Great Lakes in good stead over the next few decades?
Probably it's more of a big negative for places that don't have water than it is a positive for places that do. You'll see economic effects there where it may just become very much more expensive than it is now, and that will economically limit the amount of growth there, housing growth, population growth, and what have you.
Right. And to this, you have to think about the pricing of water. For instance, in California, where they have a big drought and they've systematically had water problems over many years, there is gross mispricing of water. I mean, for instance, as economists typically like to believe, you should be paying the marginal cost of what it is that you're actually using. So in the case of water, farmers are systematically subsidized and urban users tend to pay a lot more. So, of course, when you have that kind of mispricing, the incentive to conserve water to the extent that you otherwise would had you been paying the full marginal cost is much less. So this mispricing plays out in terms of the nature of water usage, who uses how much, and what the resultant implications are. But we don't have those kinds of issues here.
We'll be able to sit back, hopefully, in a few decades and have some comfort in our situation then.
Absolutely.
Well-placed for the zombie apocalypse eventually, too, right? We are talking money this hour with Amit Bhatabial from RIT and George Conboy from Brighton Securities. I want to bring you into the conversation, too, 844-295-TALK, 844-295-8255. On Twitter, I am at Scott Feibusch. George is at GT Conboy. Amit, are you on Twitter, too?
No.
Okay. Well, you can tweet the two of us, at least. The stock market has certainly been an interesting story this year. We're kind of, if you just look at it as beginning and end, we're kind of right back where we started, within a few hundred points on the Dow. But in the middle, we took a dip and came back up. What happened there?
That was largely due to fears about China and the effect the slowing Chinese economy would have upon economies around the world. And when after maybe 60 days or so, people realized that in the long run, it wouldn't have too terrible an effect and it wasn't going to put Procter & Gamble and Exxon out of business, our markets came back, and it has been largely a sideways slide almost all year, with the major indices either flat or down maybe a percent. NASDAQ, I think, is down a handful of percentage points. Technology's been a little bumpier. But it's been a sideways year, and frankly, we've had a few good years prior, so we can do with a sideways year. We'd just like to have a nice year next year on top of this.
I would agree with that, but I would also add that one of the big problems, at least internationally, is the European Union. I mean, this ought to be a big player in the world. After all, it's a combination of 29 countries, and they are not pulling their weight. Growth in terms of the economies in general has been anemic. They have a much older population, their birth rates are low, and on top of that, you have these problems related to the massive influx of refugees. They don't quite know how to get their act together, terrorism-related concerns. So all of that is slowing the EU economies down in a way that we ought not to see, where they are pulling their weight.
On the flip side, though, with all the discussions and all the fear earlier in the year about what effect Greece could have on the overall EU economy, everybody seems to have survived that, right?
I'm not so sure. I mean, yes, it's we've bitten the bullet for now, and things are in waiting mode with respect to Greece. But I don't think there's been a permanent solution there. Yes, we have a stopgap measure in place, and Greece is now in the back burner given some more recent concerns about refugees and terrorists. But we'll see what happens to Greece. I mean, I don't think that's a permanent solution there.
No, and it wouldn't surprise me if Greece ends up leaving the euro after all. They've done everything to keep them in. But the euro as a currency that has economic union without political union strikes me as always an awkward Frankenstein sort of currency. And the idea that it would, over the long term, rival the dollar as an international reserve currency, always a fatuous point.
It's been fascinating to see where the euro has gone with respect to the dollar in recent years, too.
Fascinating and great for travelers.
Indeed. Indeed. I mean, I want to get back to the point that you'd raised earlier about China.
Right.
And about the IMF and the renminbi. Expand on that a little bit and what effect you see that having in the year ahead.
Okay, so the Chinese economy has been growing gangbusters. I mean, there's some credibility issues with respect to the official statistics that the Chinese actually put out, but it's fair to say that their economy has been growing at 7 to 8% rates, which is phenomenal. Certainly relative to what the American economy has been growing at, and definitely what the European Union countries have been growing at. So they have basically accumulated a significant amount of not just political, but economic power with very, very large holdings of foreign exchange, particularly dollar-denominated assets. And as a result, they've been able to, push their way around not only the Asian region, but more generally exercise or flex their economic muscle to exert that economic power globally. So this year, after careful study, the IMF decided to include the Chinese currency, the renminbi or the yuan, into its basket of five reserve currencies that it basically uses to determine a whole host of IMF-related activities. So the positive is the Chinese currency will now have to play by the rules that the IMF lays down, not only in general, but for the other currencies that are in this select category of currencies. So that means the Chinese government will have less ability to play around and tinker with its currency, raise it, lower it, depending on what the domestic constituencies would like. On the negative side, what it does mean is that the growth prospects of the Chinese economy are somewhat more suspect because the Chinese government simply does not have the levers of freedom to the extent that they previously did in terms of trying to guide the economy this way or that way.
Were they levers of freedom, or were they essentially hiding behind a lack of transparency?
Well, a little bit of both. A little bit of both. So the lack of transparency allows it to basically do what it would like to do while claiming that they're subject to market forces like any other country in the world. On the other hand, the power levers are, of course, something that they very much enjoy exerting, particularly in the Asian area with respect to many of their neighbors. As you well know, there are several disputes in that area.
And the other currencies that are in that basket are what? U.S. dollar, yen, euro?
The British pound and the Japanese yen.
Japanese yen, yeah.
Indeed. We are going to take a quick break and come right back with our year-end discussion of the financial world. We are talking with Amit Bhatabial from RIT and George Conboy from Brighton Securities. And you too, we want to get you in before the end of the show at 844-295-TALK. We'll take a quick break. We will be right back on Connections.
I'm producer Megan Mack. Coming up in our second hour, we talk about green spaces, green technology, and going green with Greentopia. The nonprofit is set to unveil its first project, the Flower Garden at Brown's Race. So what exactly is Greentopia? Its founders join us in studio to share their vision and what they hope to accomplish in the next few years. That's coming up in our second hour.
Nearly 19,000 people died from prescription opioid overdoses last year.
The number of deaths is only a tip of the iceberg that's just indicating the pyramid of problems that lies beneath.
Doctors agree there's an epidemic of abuse, but they disagree on whether prescriptions are to blame. Prescribing for Pain, later on All Things Considered, from NPR News.
This afternoon at 4 on WXXI.
We are back on Connections with our year-end discussion of money and world economics as well. We are talking with George Conboy, who is the chairman of Brighton Securities. Amit Bhatabial is a professor of economics at RIT. Hope to get you in the conversation as well. 844-295-TALK, 844-295-8255. What are you thinking about financially as you get towards the end of 2015 and the beginning of 2016, just a couple of days away? Want to know what's on your mind and hopefully answer a few questions for you as well. On Twitter, I am at Scott Feibusch. George is at GT Conboy. And we do want to hear from you as well. Let's talk local a little bit, George. Obviously, you pay a lot of attention to a lot of local companies. You have a lot of longtime investors who years ago went into RG&E and Rochester Telephone and all of that. And one of the things a lot of people don't know is RG&E is suddenly a publicly traded company again after quite a few years.
Right. We haven't had them on the boards in 10 or 12 years, but they were bought some years ago by a Spanish company, Iberdrola. And just about 2 weeks ago, middle of December, Iberdrola brought public what used to be Iberdrola USA, and they now call Avangrid, A-V-A-N-G-R-I-D, crazy made-up corporate name. But Avangrid comprises RG&E, New York State Electric and Gas, Central Maine Power, one of the Connecticut utilities. So it's a conglomerate of Northeast electric utilities that just started trading 2 years ago. It's on the New York Stock Exchange symbol AGR. So first time we've been able to invest in RG&E in a long time. And all we'd ask is that you keep sending in your monthly check, please.
Is there still such a thing as widow and orphan stocks?
I think there are. I think there's some widow and orphan
stocks. And is that one of them?
It remains to be seen, probably, sure. Some of the better electric utilities would still fit in that category. Maybe we should explain that jargon. The theory was that if you were a widow or an orphan, you can't afford to roll the dice and you want to have something fairly safe. I suspect that this utility will be that. I had a question from someone today about, should we be concerned about RG&E because of the Ginna nuclear plant, but the reality is that plant was sold many years ago. RG&E no longer owns that plant, so that's sort of a moot point for them.
Well, that's one of the things that I wonder about in looking at what were once these very safe bets, is that the production and the distribution have been separated.
Right.
across most of the country, so you don't have that. And same thing with, you know, telephone companies. At one time, those were. And we look out the window here and up the street at Kodak, which certainly, if it was ever a widow and orphan stock, isn't anymore. Sort things out. Who are the winners? Who are the losers locally this year besides
So
besides
locally,
Argini?
It's some old names who really took it hard. Eastman Kodak, this calendar year, down 40%. They are currently just under $13 a share, and they were north of 20 this time last year. So they're down 40%. Xerox down 22%, and they've had their own struggles with transitioning to the brave new world of services and the declining sales of copiers. I don't have any beef with how Xerox has handled that transition, but I have a tremendous beef with the idea that over the last year they spent $1.3 or thereabouts billion buying back their own stock. I think it's a foolish move when a year ago Xerox was $13 or $14 and management spent $1 billion and change buying back their own stock. Better off paying a cash dividend to shareholders. I think they're wasting shareholder money. The other big down year, of course, this year in local stocks, to the extent it's local, is Valeant, down 60% this year, and that's been a tremendous roller coaster. Of course, they own Bausch & Lomb.
I was going to say, this is the company that once was the Bausch & Lomb widow and orphan stock.
Right, right.
We got winners here. You're very bullish on Constellation Brands.
Great winners with Constellation Brands, the former Canandaigua Wine Company. They made some big moves this year in the beer market. They just bought for north of $1 billion Ballast Point Brewing. That's a craft brew. They made some other acquisitions. And for the first time in the company's history, and I think Constellation Brands was founded shortly after World War II, first time ever they paid a cash dividend to shareholders, a real plus. Expectations are they will raise that cash dividend. So Constellation Brands up 45, 46% this year. Paychex up nearly 20% this year. They had a great year as well. Still just doing their thing. No specific spectacular news, but nice solid year from some of the hometown team members.
Any thoughts on the local economy and local players, Simon?
The local economy in general continues to be relatively stable. Some local stocks are doing pretty well, as George has pointed out. The two that kept leap up to me are Constellation doing well and Paychex. But I would say that one of the key things about the local economy is that people living in the area typically are not speculators. They're looking for stable house prices, a good environment in which to raise their family. So in that kind of an environment, things are pretty stable, nothing out of whack.
Okay. Let's go to the phones. 844-295-8255 is our number. John in Rochester, you are on with us, and you have a question about where things are going with interest rates, right?
Yes, Scott. This is probably addressed on my more than George, but I see the low interest rates that we've had, historically low. I remember back in '81, when I opened up a company in '81, interest rates were like 17, 18%, and now we've got these low interest rates. And I really think that those low interest rates have fueled the recovery from 2008-2009, and what concerns me is this. To keep those interest rates at that level, the Federal Reserve has to manipulate the money supply to the point where it's got to be an expensive venture. I know with the quantitative easing policy they had, that's a very expensive problem, and I'm not sure what the balance sheet of the Federal Reserve looks like, but I think they're on the verge of maybe something that could really hurt the economy long run. The other thing is the fiscal policies, where we've got a $19 trillion national debt, concerns me also. Ahmed, what do you think about what Reagan did to recover the economy back in the 80s using Milt Friedman's economic philosophy, supply-side economics, versus what we're doing right now? What are your thoughts there?
Okay. So I should say, thanks for that question, John. I should say at the outset that I personally am not a big fan of supply-side economics because it targets just one half of the problem, and the empirical evidence, if you look at it, is at best mixed in terms of what it does to the economy. But let me address some of the other issues that you've pointed out. It is certainly true that our $19 trillion debt is a major issue, and it's something that we definitely ought to be thinking about. But the fact of the matter is, The United States enjoys certain unique advantages as the provider of the world's reserve currency and, at least right now, being the world's biggest economy, which allows it to act in certain ways that other countries simply couldn't. So we're basically milking that advantage, definitely. And this ties into the related issue that you mentioned about the Fed's policy in terms of keeping interest rates low and the extent to which it has been successful in quantitative easing. Now, this again is related to the fact that because we have the world's reserve currency, the Federal Reserve's actions are watched and followed in a way that many other central bankers in different countries of the world simply could not. Now, quantitative easing, simply put, is just basically buying government debt.
Right.
And when you buy your own government's debt, that gives the government a certain degree of freedom in order to pursue policies that it otherwise couldn't. But it is absolutely true that this kind of policy framework in which interest rates continue to remain so low for extended periods of time definitely helps certain segments of the economy. It is also the case that you cannot keep doing this indefinitely.
It's almost like there's IOU between the federal government with Social Security and et cetera. They're issuing almost IOUs and the Federal Reserve to a certain extent. Between the two of them, they're bouncing these IOUs. And to me, it's kind of dangerous. In fact, there was a professor, a Boston University economist, that testified before Congress like in February, who said that our real financial, he called it a financial gap, is not $19 trillion, it's actually $210 trillion if you take into consideration all our liabilities, including the Federal Reserve. I forget the economist's name, but he was a high-level economist at Boston University.
Maybe it was Larry Kotlikoff?
That sounds, yes, I think it was, yes.
Okay.
Would you care to comment on that $210 trillion, what he called financial gap?
That number, I'm not sure how he came up with that particular number, but it depends on how you do the accounting. I mean, there is definitely some leeway in terms of how you count the government's debts in terms of what actually its external holdings and its internal holdings are. Now, you're right that in terms of the activities, as far as quantitative easing is concerned between the Fed, it's basically distributing resources, or more specifically IOUs, between the government itself and this independent entity that we call the Federal Reserve. But then you also have to mention the fact that there is a significant external holdings of U.S. Debt, with the Chinese being our principal holder of this particular debt. So that's the part that worries me a little bit more than the specific quantitative easing that is actually being undertaken by the Fed. Moreover, it's important to note that this quantitative easing, massive, large-scale buying of government debt, is basically come to an end. It's not going to happen anytime in the foreseeable future unless there's some dramatic collapse of a completely unforeseen nature that no one basically foresaw. This has been going on for a while, and it was actually necessary, but it's basically come to an end. So you're going to see interest rates going up very slowly initially, by which I mean, say, the next 12 months, while the Fed is in this wait-and-see mode. And if unemployment numbers and inflation numbers are in the range that it generally likes, you're going to see interest rates going up, but very, very slowly. And as George mentioned a couple of minutes ago, thus far, the impact of raising the interest rate, it's a minuscule raise, has basically had no real impact on the economy. But I think that will change as the Fed changes its policy, assuming nothing unforeseen happens with any significant part of the economy, particularly the U.S. economy.
It almost seems like, Ahmed, that the government, between the Federal Reserve and the government itself, it's almost like a Ponzi scheme to a certain extent.
Don't lose sight of something, John, that Ahmed said that you may have overlooked. I think people overlook a lot. We are economically almost the only game in town. No one's comparable. The Chinese economy may ultimately overtake us in terms of total size. Government is not the least bit trustworthy. Europe's a wonderful place, but they've got monetary union without political union, and their currency is soft right now. There is no other large economy with the same valuable mix of free commerce, a free nation, a place people want to go, a diversified economy that can sell both goods and services all around the world. There is no other place. And so our economy, our currency, both derive meaningful gains from that special status. And it looks to me like that's unlikely to change anytime soon.
Well, what concerns me, George, is what happened in 2008. It was almost like night and day. All of a sudden, things were going along, and we were into a little recession, and all of a sudden, things went drastically wrong. And that's what I think we might be facing now with this, between the Federal Reserve, improper ways of stimulating the economy for this period of time, and then our debt that we're running up on the fiscal side. I think we might hit something overnight like we did in October 2008.
Remember, that happened all around the world. That wasn't just here. That
but
was
it could
an international
be driven
phenomenon.
By Greece and whatever. And Western, you guys were talking about Greece and Western Europe, and that could...
Yeah, I think Greece is going to be too small to cause that kind of problem. Right.
Okay. Anyways, I appreciate you guys. I've enjoyed your discussion today.
All right, thanks for the call, John.
Thanks very much.
I appreciate it. You can join our conversation, too. We still have a few minutes left. 844-295-TALK, 844-295-8255 is the phone number, on Twitter at Scott Feibusch. We are talking with George Conboy, chairman of Brighton Securities, Amit Bhatabial from RIT. Let's talk politics a little bit, because obviously everything that John was referring to in 08 played a very big role in the election later that year. We are coming up into an election year, although it feels like it's been going on for two or 3 years already. I want to ask, first of all, is there anything that either of you can really even identify concretely enough in any of the economic policies that have been put forward by any of the major candidates that's even detailed enough to be able to comment on at this point?
Well, this question is very much dependent on your perception of the actual problem. So you have some candidates, Bernie Sanders probably typifies this the most, who believe that the deck is unfairly stacked against a large number of Americans, with a very small percentage of Americans in the neighborhood of 1% or maybe 2% who make dramatic gains at the expense of the remainder of the population. So this zero-sum picture of the American economy causes him to put forward a bunch of proposals which are typically, say for lack of better terminology, populist. They're designed to bring back a greater share of the GDP pie, or the American cake, if you will, to large numbers of people who are not benefiting. Then on the other side, you have some groups, say on the Republican side, if you look at people like, say, Marco Rubio or Ted Cruz or even Donald Trump to the extent that he has any meaningful proposal, who believe that, you know, the American economy works best when certain segments of the population who are, in fact, the drivers of job growth, the entrepreneurial class, if you will, are left to do what they do best. That is, create new ideas, innovate, employ people, and make good strides for the American economy in general. So the policies that we are seeing right now, with a few exceptions, are basically mirroring that perspective in terms of what each candidate believes the basic problem is as far as the economy is concerned. Now, muddying waters is very recent concerns about national security. So economic policies, which is where the campaign began, looming large on the center stage, have somewhat taken a backseat now to many of these national security concerns, particularly in the aftermath of the killings in San Bernardino. So those concerns are now very, very much significant in the eyes of most candidates. And of course, polls suggest the American population in general as well.
My perspective is you've got a whole field of candidates on both sides of the aisle. I get asked all the time for over 30 years, what about this proposed tax bill? How do you think it'll affect me? I say, look, don't ask me about a proposed tax bill. When they sign the tax bill, we'll read the tax bill and we'll deal with the new tax rules. And when they get two candidates, so you can go into a voting booth and vote for one, I'll evaluate their policies. But for the time being, I'm not spending a lot of effort evaluating, because I can't vote for these people. Not for president. You can vote in a primary, but when they've got two candidates, I'll evaluate. For now, I'm blissfully putting myself outside worrying about politics for a while.
If you look, you know, there's one particular branch economically that seems not to be going very far on the Republican side of things, and that's Rand Paul and his father Ron, who, you know, have had a very clearly stated set of economic policies over the years, and I think that's where some of the concern that we were hearing from the caller about the state of the Fed has come from. Why is that not taking off? Why is that not picking up a lot of steam, do you think, politically? Is it just the Trump factor on that side of the aisle?
I'm a little surprised that Rand Paul hasn't gotten a little more traction in this field, because he is a bit of a different candidate. But certainly when you've got somebody like Donald Trump taking a lot of the oxygen out of some of the various events they've had, it's harder to get your ideas heard, perhaps. But I'm surprised, frankly, at Rand not getting more traction.
At the risk of dragging you back into this political landscape that you're trying so very hard to avoid, is there anything concrete that you can say? You know, Donald Trump and to a lesser extent Carly Fiorina put themselves out there as being the candidates with business experience. How relevant is that to actually running a country and to running the sort of economy that you have on a national level instead of within one private company?
It's interesting. Fiorina and Trump, and to one extent Bernie Sanders, although he is a longtime politician, Trump and Sanders seem to be bookending the field by being people who will say anything and they don't care about the consequence. I give them both credit for that. Love them or hate them, they're going to say what they think or what they think they think without regard to consequence. And it might be refreshing to have some administrators in political positions who aren't beholden to a political network, who don't have the kind of patronage that gets you a bus company job the week after you leave office or what have you. I'd be very welcome to seeing someone who's not beholden to either political side.
I would add to that. I think one of the key reasons why you see a candidate like Trump getting so much traction is this attitude that I don't care what you think. I'm going to say it if I think it's the right thing to say, which I think appeals to a lot of people. Because he's not beholden to any particular, segment of the population or any particular media group to fund his campaign. So he basically funds himself and says whatever he wants. So that allows him a certain degree of freedom, which he's really tapping into. And I think it should be added that, you know, I think as a businessman, he's a great marketer. I mean, he makes these horrible comments and says, you know, we should put a temporary hold on all Muslims coming into the country. Yet you learned just 2 days ago there is a massive property going on in Turkey where he's basically giving his name, not even his personal property, to what is essentially a property in a Muslim country. So he's a very good marketer, and he loves getting, as George said, pulling the oxygen out of the room at the events that he's typically, the master of. And that, you know, needs to be recognized. But Carly Fiorina, I have my doubts about her. Yeah, yes, it's true, she was CEO of HP, but I don't think she did anything constructive during her time there. And there are a significant number of people with a lot of knowledge about this particular position who do not believe that she was an outstanding CEO. So her experience, while not irrelevant, I doubt it puts her in a particularly strong standing as far as the Republican group of candidates is concerned.
Are we capable as an electorate, do you think? Do most of us have the economic knowledge that we need to really make sense of these policies and to make informed decisions about who it is we're voting for and what policies we're voting for?
No, not less than many of the candidates, frankly.
I would agree. I would say that I think that's not true in the sense that most Americans do not have the knowledge to make fine-tuned decisions, but George's point from a couple of minutes ago is relevant here. It's really not necessary to know every I, whether every I has been dotted and every T crossed, because these proposals are all across the board. We need to have the candidates, the pool of candidates winnowed down significantly before you can really start to examine carefully what a person is or isn't saying in a meaningful way.
Even at that point, are we going to get enough detail economically about what it is they're proposing to be able to make sense of it?
I sure hope so, because that will be one key basis on which to make an informed decision about who one would like to vote for.
We are down to our final minutes. One thing that we haven't mentioned so far is precious metals as a commodity.
Blah. How's that? How's that for a sound effect?
They certainly have been on a downtrend, not just this past year, but previous years, too. Is there any reason to think that that's going to change?
I think it's a long-term loser. I mean, you'll have spikes. Commodity prices are among the most volatile assets you can own. And you'll occasionally have a spike where you'll make a lot of money, but it's a little bit like the guy who hits the $11 million lottery down at the local store. You want to go down there and buy a ticket because there's that glow or that buzz, but it's not going to happen that frequently, in my opinion.
There's an interesting statistic that I saw recently, specifically about Donald Trump, that said, and I haven't verified this, but I believe it to be reasonably true, that if he took the money that he had inherited in the 1970s from his father, and had just put in an index fund and just let it sit for 40 years, that he'd be worth something like twice or three times as much as he is now, having invested it the way he did over the years. If he can't do it, as Joe Average Investor, what do you tell people who come into you maybe at the end of the year and say, hey, I had a good year, what should I get ready for next year? What do you tell them they should be doing?
Well, I'll preface all my comments about individuals with the obvious disclaimer that it depends on the individual circumstance. But the reality is there are only two ways to invest. It's going to be debt or equity. That is, you can lend your money or you can own something. And lending and owning typically takes the form of either a bank account, you're eventually lending your money that way, or bonds, you're lending your money, or you own a mutual fund or individual stocks, and that's a form of equity or ownership. And over time, equity creates value. Lending does not. The caveat, of course, is you must be able to stand more volatility, more risk to invest in the equity markets, and not everybody can stand that. So a lot of times it comes down to the other side of personal finance. Be careful with your budget. Don't spend more than you make. And a lot of times, if the advice you're hearing sounds something like your father or your grandfather would give you, it's probably good advice.
Very quickly, because we're down to about our final minute here, one or two lines, what's going to be the economic story of 2016?
Okay, so let me get my crystal ball out. So I think the two or three major things to watch in the next 12 months would be, one, the energy sector, and strategies employed by the key OPEC players, and in this case, the single biggest player is Saudi Arabia.
Okay.
That's one.
Two and three, very quickly. We're almost out of time.
Okay, two and three is what happens to China in terms of their growth policies. And finally, what happens at home. I don't expect anything significant to happen, but we are the major and significant player in town. So what happens at home has a significant effect, not just here, but everywhere else in the world as well.
George, a couple of words.
Bankruptcies in the oil patch, watch for them and their repercussions on the economy. Not the big boys, but the smaller, more leveraged players.
George Conboy, Chairman of Brighton Securities. I'm Amit Bhatia from RIT. I'm Scott Feibusch. Thanks to Val LaBanca, our engineer this hour, and our producer, Megan Mack. She's in next hour. Stay with us. It's Connections.